Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Coronavirus numbers continue to rise. More than 24,000 people infected, more than 500 people have died. The outbreak is having a tremendous impact on China's economy and the world's, too. On Monday, the Chinese Communist Party itself seemed to affirm the epidemic's potentially destabilizing effect. The leaders called the coronavirus epidemic, quote, a major test of China's system and capacity for governance. So what does President Xi's handling of the outbreak so far tell us about the inner workings of modern China, its future, its relationship to the rest of the world? This hour on Point, China and coronavirus. And you can join us. Has coronavirus affected the way you understand China or how it operates or its importance, its centrality in the modern world? Might this disease change things within China? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we're joined today first by Elizabeth Economy. She's with us from New York. She's an expert on China's domestic and foreign policy, also a senior fellow and director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and a distinguished visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, author of many books, including The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Elizabeth Economy, welcome to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us today is John Pomfret. He joins us from San Francisco. He's a contributing opinion writer for The Washington Post, formerly the paper's Beijing bureau chief. He's also lived in China for nearly 20 years, author of many books, including The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. John, welcome to you. John Pomfret, are you there? Okay, we're going to work on getting John on the line here. So, Elizabeth, let me begin with you. I'd kind of like to approach this hour as a series of concentric circles, if we may. First, beginning with President Xi himself, then broadening out to the Chinese people, and then to China's impact on the world, all seen through the lens of coronavirus right now. So starting with President Xi, how would you evaluate how he's led China so far in the first few weeks of grappling with coronavirus?
Well, this is really the house that Xi built, right? So what we're seeing in terms of the Chinese Communist Party's response to the coronavirus has everything to do with the sort of enhancement of a restrained and repressed Chinese political system that Xi Jinping has put in place over the past 7 years since he came to power. You see a greater centralization of power, the creation of a sort of climate of fear among local officials. They are actually afraid to report news up the chain, the political chain, for fear of getting their heads lopped off. You see much tighter information control than you had in China pre-Xi Jinping. So as much attention is being paid to addressing the challenge of the coronavirus, we also see an enormous amount of attention being paid to online chatter and criticism of the Communist Party and hunting down those people who are being critical. And you have a campaign mentality. So, you know, this is something that other countries often admire about China, that top-down sort of put everything into motion, mobilize for war ability. And indeed, you can see that China was able to, you know, build two hospitals or quarantine centers in 2 weeks. But at the same time, you know, there's a rigidity to the system. So getting the medical supplies and doctors exactly where they need to go has not been moving especially well. There's a lack of a feedback mechanism. You don't have civil society. You don't have the media reporting freely. You don't have non-governmental organizations and activists able to bring information into the system, much needed information. So I think the sort of the problems that we've seen, many of them in addressing the coronavirus in China, are a creation of the Chinese political system and in particular of Xi Jinping's sort of concentration of power into his own hands and into the hands of the Communist Party.
Okay, fascinating. So, but if I have this right, until Monday, just a couple of days ago, there was a period of time in which President Xi hadn't actually made all that many public statements or was sort of keeping a lower profile than usual. Do I have that right?
You do. And I think that's, you know, one of, if frankly, if I have been surprised by anything over the past, you know, I guess really it's been 2 months, but say month and a bit since we first learned about the coronavirus, it's been that Xi Jinping has really not put himself out in the limelight. He, you know, has assumed the mantle, every mantle that he can think of, he has assumed, most recently, you know, trying to claim the mantle of the people's leader. But you would expect the people's leader to be out among the people during such a time, perhaps even visiting Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus epidemic. And, you know, sort of mixing among the people, giving them comfort. Instead, he has dispatched Li Keqiang, the premier, to play the sort of front and center role. It's not that unusual for the premier to take charge in a crisis like that, but like this. But it is, in fact, unusual for the premier leader not to play a more active role.
It's unusual in China because I was wondering if the presumption that a leader would be, you know, in public spaces visiting the epicenter of any sort of disaster, is that a Western presumption or is that also a common practice in China?
Well, it's common practice for a leader to be doing that. Okay. It doesn't have to be Xi Jinping. It's only surprising, again, in the context that Xi Jinping has put himself forward,
right
as the premier leader, as the people's leader. I mean, literally that appellation he has given to himself. And so, again, I think you would anticipate that, you know, with all power going to Xi Jinping, all problems redound to him, too. And he really should be the person addressing this.
Okay. Let's continue focusing on President Xi's response right now and what it tells us. Because, as you said, even though he's been keeping kind of an unusually lower profile, on Monday there was this meeting of the Communist Party, right? And I'm seeing reports here that on Monday President Xi called on all officials in the country to make reducing the numbers of coronavirus infections a top priority, and I think he also said that they were lacking, saying that officials who were resisting orders from the central government were lacking boldness and could be punished. What does that tell you?
Well, again, part of the problem that's emerged over the past 7 years is that with Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign and his campaign to looking at local officials to assess their political loyalty to him personally, right, they have become far less bold, far less risk-taking. We've seen it in the economy where the Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang have had to, on a number of occasions, urge local officials, right, to undertake new projects, to experiment, because nobody, again, is willing to stick his or her neck out. They don't want to be seen by Xi Jinping. So that kind of boldness has been much reduced under Xi Jinping. And now he wants them to be bold. But the truth is, people will be caught trying to understand, you know, from one command coming from the central government to the next, right? They don't want to get caught in between two commands, two different commands or contradictory commands, and end up on the wrong side of things. So I think that's a big part of the problem. And so what are they learning from the central government? What are they exactly supposed to do? I think, you know, we don't know the specific recommendations and instructions that are coming down from the top. I mean, if it's simply reduce the number of coronavirus, you know, patients, what are the local officials supposed to do? So it would be good to know whether or not they are getting very explicit instructions about how to manage the problem. And then if they do that or don't do that, then that's something to be evaluated upon. But I guess my guess would be, frankly, that they are not getting those kinds of instructions.
I see. Because I was just wondering when he said lacking boldness, was that, as you were saying, sort of a waiting for more detailed further instructions from Xi himself? Or was it a response, a pushback to the government's, some of the government, Chinese government's draconian measures so far, right? The locking down of tens of millions of people.
Yeah, it could be, frankly, that in some places they haven't closed down all the industries or they haven't done as effective a job of quarantining people. We really don't know, you know, what's taking place in a number of these cities and provinces that Xi Jinping, you know, where he could be referring to in specific cases of officials not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Frankly, what I found extremely interesting in the earlier days was when the mayor of Wuhan, you know, who was clearly shouldering the blame for all of this, mm-hmm. you know, stood up in an interview, pushed back against the central government and said, you know, listen, I provided the information. Yes, there are deficiencies in the way that I manage the process, but I provided the information, but I was not authorized to make it public. Right. And so that's a very unusual thing to have happen for a local official to say, hey, I'm not going to take all of the blame for this. You know, you guys are responsible because you did not give me permission to release this information. So that dynamic between the center and the sort of localities is a very complicated one. Mm. And again, we don't know exactly what the central government is telling those local officials in terms of what they should be doing.
Interesting. So, Elizabeth, could coronavirus potentially be somewhat destabilizing in China? I mean, economically, we're already seeing China is so tied in with the global economy now that there have to be immediate impacts. Are there potentially politically destabilizing impacts here?
I think, you know, it's certainly possible. I think that will depend on how long the coronavirus, you know, continues to spread or whether the epidemic is brought under control reasonably quickly. I think Xi Jinping has tried to get out ahead of the criticism. And so, you know, maybe a week ago or so, he said, you know, yes, there are some deficiencies in our system. We need better crisis management, and we're going to close down all the wet markets, you know, those markets where they have the animals, the live animals, which is, you know, where the coronavirus, you know, first appeared in Wuhan. So he's trying to say, you know, this isn't about, you know, really, you know, free flow of information and the sort of the Communist Party. This is about a crisis management system that we need to put in place. Right, which really will translate into simply more control, right? Greater central control over localities. So I think that's the message he's trying to get out there. You know, do I think that the credibility of the government is being undermined? I do think it's starting, and I think there's more to be said about that as well.
Well, we'll explore that more when we come back. Elizabeth Economy joins us this hour. She's Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're talking about how the handling of coronavirus thus far within China tells us about the Chinese government and China's place on the world stage as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how the handling of the coronavirus epidemic inside of China and how that what that tells us about the Chinese government, about President Xi, and China's place today on the world stage. I'm joined today by Elizabeth Economy. She's a senior fellow and director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And joining us now, hopefully, fingers crossed, is John Pomfret. He's a contributing opinion writer for The Washington Post, was formerly the Beijing bureau chief for The Post. He lived in China for roughly 20 years and is author of The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the present. John, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. Are you there this time with us?
I am indeed.
Okay.
You know, we're kind of like Iowa over here in California.
Digital breakdowns everywhere. Thank you for your patience, John. It's great to have you on the show. You heard, hopefully, Elizabeth's fascinating analysis about President Xi's leadership at this moment. And let's just start there with you. I mean, do you see similar patterns that part of the story of the outbreak so far is the story of the complete centralizing of political power around President Xi?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is, as Liz said, the system that Xi built. This is his house. I mean, you have a situation now where across the country for many years, about a third of the work time of local officials is being spent on political study, basically studying party documents that all point to the necessity for centralizing power in the hands of Xi Jinping. And these officials are now being forced to confront a very real epidemic, and they don't have the tools to really deal with this, partially because they've spent so much time and they've been appointed and given promotions based on the fact of, not on competence, but on the fact of that they've expressed loyalty to Xi Jinping. So I think this is a huge challenge for Xi Jinping himself personally, but also for the system of government that he's created in China.
As I said at the top of the show, I kind of want to look at this as concentric circles. So let's pull out a little bit. Is there evidence in China, even given the information control, that there might be some discontent amongst the Chinese people on how the epidemic has been handled so far?
Definitely. I mean, there's two epidemics happening in China right now. There's the epidemic of the coronavirus disease, but there's also an epidemic of criticism. And you see it on Weibo and also on Weixin, that China's two versions of, let's say, Twitter and other social media. Last night I was reading a long posting by a propaganda official who actually wrote his real name, criticizing the system, basically taking many of Liz's points, saying, you know, everything's concentrated in the hands of the senior leader, we can't do anything without approval from Beijing, et cetera, et cetera. And that post had been already shared 30,000 times. By the time I finished it, however, and I attempted to share it myself, it had been deleted. But this type of stuff is happening increasingly. And so you really do get the sense that there's growing criticism. Now, the challenge for Xi is going to be not simply controlling the epidemic, and who knows when that's going to happen, but also being able to control and to squelch the epidemic of criticism as well. And those are basically the two challenges that he's facing.
Okay, so that epidemic of criticism, though, John, I mean, was it one of those things that was ripe to erupt or to emerge, and coronavirus is the thing that sort of accelerated it?
Well, I mean, in a system that Xi has created, I mean, he's taken out so many of the potential pressure valve release mechanisms. He's squelched whatever semi-free media. He's rolled up dissidents and human rights lawyers. He's launched basically a full-bore campaign to squash any type of inter-ethnic trouble out in Xinjiang province by, you know, incarcerating upwards of 1 million people in these thought reform camps. And so he's really squeezed the system in a way that his predecessors haven't. And I think that coronavirus has been a trigger for a lot of discontent and a lot of criticism. I mean, you know, we currently have upwards of 100 million people who have been put in quarantine. I mean, that's now his legacy, right? This is a guy who really wanted his legacy to be uniting China, taking over Taiwan, bringing China onto the stage as a global superpower. And instead, he's now facing a legacy of a guy who's slapped 100 million people plus in quarantine and dealing with this massive coronavirus. So I think that the criticism is there, and coronavirus was basically a trigger for it.
You know, every time we have a conversation about China, I think it's worth to stop and reflect about scale here, because 100 million people on some form of quarantine, that's equivalent to almost a third of the entire United States. I mean, it's massive. Elizabeth, reflect on what John's saying about the potential for an epidemic of dissent or criticism of the government.
Well, I think John is right. You know, that dissent still exists, but it's, you know, been put under a lid. So it hasn't boiled over because he really has cut off many of the mechanisms by which people could dissent, right? So you don't see the types of protests on the street that we saw pre-Xi Jinping. You don't have the openness in the internet that there used to exist pre-Xi Jinping. And again, you see the party leadership at this point expending as much effort managing the coronavirus epidemic as managing the dissent and talking about how people will be punished and already punishing people. You know, the app that the government has come up with is one, it's a whistleblower app so that the Chinese people can report on official malfeasance. But if you look at what the Chinese people are doing themselves, they're trying to create platforms to share information, to talk about, you know, here are the neighborhoods where, you know, we've seen the disease, the coronavirus break out. Here's information. I'm attempting to verify it to ensure that it's true. So I think the difference in how the Chinese people are looking at this coronavirus and the way the government is approaching it is quite significant. You know, is this going to pose a real challenge to the leadership of Xi Jinping? I think certainly it's eating at the credibility of the Communist Party, no doubt. And Xi Jinping, you know, maybe will make it through this, but he could end up being, you know, moved to the second line, which is what happened to Mao Zedong after the Great Leap Forward. So where Xi Jinping is no longer this paramount leader, you know, so that he makes all the decisions, but becomes one among and one within a collective leadership. I don't think the Communist Party would be ready to boot him, really, but I do think it's possible that it could cause him to be more constrained moving forward.
Okay, so forgive sort of my ignorance, my inability to see through the opacity of the Chinese government, but how would that work, Elizabeth, if she is essentially also, quote, the chairman of everything? Does that mean that the party itself still controls, has a great deal of power about who she is and what he does?
Yeah, it would require really the Standing Committee of the Politburo and the Politburo probably to come to some consensus that Xi Jinping had mismanaged this. And, you know, about a year and a half ago, and John will remember this, there were a lot of rumors circulating that Xi Jinping was under pressure within the top echelons of the Chinese leadership for overreach, right? There was criticism about the Belt and Road Initiative. There was criticism about his handling of the U.S.-China relationship. You know, there were the Hong Kong protests. There was a sense that many of Xi Jinping's sort of big initiatives were under fire, right, and were bringing negative attention to China. So, you know, it's possible, and he weathered that, but it's possible that this coronavirus could become yet another issue that would signal a challenge, really, to the preeminence of Xi Jinping's leadership.
Interesting. John, do you see something similar there?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the panoply of issues that he's dealt with, he's failed every time, but he's failed upwards. But the problem is the coronavirus is now huge and it's affecting everybody in China. And so I think it will be extremely interesting to see how the party reacts to this crisis in terms of whether they're going to, as Liz contemplated, the potential for him to be brought down a notch and for them to reassert collective leadership, because, you know, Xi Jinping really blew that whole idea up and demanding complete control over everything. And I think that this crisis illustrates and probably amounts to the greatest challenge to his position since he gained control of the Communist Party in 2012.
I have to say, this is absolutely fascinating, because for the casual observer, you know, lacking the knowledge that the two of you have, it seems as if China has been undergoing this long-term sort of internal consolidation of power around President Xi as it continues its ascent as a global superpower. So to hear that all is not as guaranteed as we had once thought is fascinating. So let's go to our calls. Allie is calling from Portland, Maine. Allie, you're on the air.
Hi. So I just wanted to report in that the number that the news keeps on reporting is 500 for deaths, and there's many, many more than that, that people are dying in their homes because the hospitals are full and there's not enough ambulances, and that number is very skewed.
So, Ali, if I might ask, how you say you're reporting in, based on what knowledge do you have?
I have a friend in Shanghai currently. She lives and works in China.
And so what more is she telling you?
How sick her friend's family members are getting. And she's had one member that's actually passed, not in her family, but her friends, and can't get into the hospitals because they're full.
Oh, interesting. Okay, Ali, thank you so much for that call. Elizabeth, should we be questioning the numbers coming out of China right now?
I think Ali is right. And there have been some reports coming, you know, on the ground from Chinese citizens, you know, talking about how, and not to be morbid, but how crematoriums are, you know, operating at full capacity and shortening the amount of time that they are required to cremate bodies so that they can accommodate more, you know, pictures of, you know, dead bodies in hospitals that are not being moved. And of course, you know, scores of reports of people who are simply being sent home and, you know, not acknowledged with the coronavirus because the hospitals simply can't deal with them. So I would not be surprised at all if the number of deaths at this point is, you know, significantly underreported.
Okay. So John, then help us understand that possibility, given that at the same time, in fact, on this very show last week, we had scientists say that in comparison to China's response to SARS back in the beginning of the 2000s, that at least in terms of cooperation with global health officials, China has been much more open and connected than it was back in 2002, 2003.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really interesting point, Meghna, and it illustrates some of the schizophrenia in the Chinese system right now, is that on the expert side, in terms of the folks who liaise with the World Health Organization and liaise with other governments, there was, you know, the Chinese dealt with this relatively quickly. When the virus popped up, if you will, in early December, the health experts were very quick to trace the genome of the virus, to identify the virus, to provide information to international organizations, even including the United States. But on the other side, on the political side, the folks who are basically directly responsible to Xi Jinping, they moved extremely slowly, partially because, as Liz noted, and as the mayor of Wuhan claimed, he needed to get approval from the higher-ups in order for him to make any and move on any quarantine or make any announcements in getting people involved. And it was sort of fascinating when, several days ago, the spokesman of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs attempted to blame the United States in part for not helping China. And in the statement that the spokesman made, the spokesman said, well, on January 3rd, we told the Americans about our problem, and the Americans didn't do anything. It's part of this Chinese blame game that they're playing with the United States over the fact that they claim America hasn't helped China. But the interesting thing was that in China, the response on the web and in Weibo was that on January 3rd, you told the Americans, how come you didn't tell the Chinese? And so that illustrates this gap between what the experts are doing in China, which is, and they've gotten credit from the WHO for doing really, really good work. At the same time, the politicians in China have failed their own people.
Elizabeth, what do you think about that?
I think it's a really interesting distinction that John has made, and I think the scientific community absolutely wants to be in coordination and cooperate with the international scientific community. It did take the Chinese quite a while to accept the offer of the international scientists to come into China to help, and that was a political decision, right? They didn't make that decision until after the World Health Organization had visited China. But I think we've seen, you know, the damage that the political controls have done within China, I think has been striking. I think in terms of how China has dealt with the outside world, it's also been very interesting. It's in many respects a reflection of the same sort of narratives that it's developing at home, namely that, you know, we are rising to the challenge, the leadership is rising to the challenge, but then threatening consequences if you don't fall in line. So Chinese ambassadors everywhere are delivering, you know, these two messages, right, that China is competent and capable and going to meet the challenge of the coronavirus, that it's behaving in a transparent manner, sharing information with the international community, but also that the alarmist response of, you know, many other countries, like including banning air transport and closing borders to Chinese, is not helpful, right? And there can be consequences for countries that behave this way. And it's really quite extraordinary. I was at a conference at UC San Diego over the weekend where the Chinese ambassador to the United States, Cui Qiankai, basically delivered that very message. And I have to say, I was struck. It was really quite tonally off,
yeah.
I thought.
Consequences meaning what? What was the implication?
Well, I think, you know, China's preferred method of imposing consequences is, you know, some sort of economic payback over time. So some kind of sanctioning of, you know, imports from a certain country. Again, this is not just directed at the United States.
Yeah.
This message was also delivered, I believe, in Indonesia and elsewhere.
But of course, unlike several decades ago or, you know, half a century ago, it's not empty rhetoric when China says something like that now, I mean, given its economic power, right?
It's not empty rhetoric, but you would be surprised at how many countries actually resist those threats. you know, when China says you need to accommodate to our political priorities and our values and our way of doing things, if it impinges in any way on other countries' core values or their own security, they tend to reject China's, you know, attempt to use economic leverage to force alignment.
Interesting. Well, Elizabeth Economy and John Pomfret, stand by. We are talking about what China's handling of the coronavirus epidemic says about China today, both internally and on the world stage. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about how China's handling of the coronavirus epidemic so far, how that tells us about China, or what it tells us, I should say, about China's place on the world stage and China today. I'm joined today by Elizabeth Economy. She's a senior fellow and director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a number of books on China, including Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. John Pomfret also joins us. He's a contributing opinion writer for The Washington Post, was the Post's Beijing bureau chief and lived in China for roughly 20 years, author of The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, America, China, 1776 to the present. And let's go to our calls. Let's go to Cheryl, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Cheryl, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to say I find it curious to listen to how China is being criticized for what it's doing to deal with this epidemic, especially since they're doing so different after the criticisms that they received for how they dealt with the SARS virus. So they're doing now everything that the West has asked or demanded that they do, and we're still criticizing them. I wonder, what are we doing to help them instead of just criticizing them?
Mm. Cheryl, thank you for that question. John Pomfret, do you have an answer for Cheryl?
Well, it's a good point. You know, in 2003, there was a significant amount of criticism because China really didn't talk to the West about its challenges. This time, they've actually really improved, and I think I noted that in sort of the mixed message that China has been sending, one to its people and the other to the international community. So in terms of liaising with the international community, they've definitely improved since 2003 when the SARS epidemic erupted. But in terms of dealing with their own people, in many ways, they're facing similar challenges, and it's in some ways gotten worse, partially because of the centralization of power in the hands of Xi Jinping in the center of the party.
Mm. Elizabeth, your thoughts on that?
So I think certainly there has been an improvement in terms of China's outward reach to the international community, but it really hasn't been where it should be, frankly. I think, look, they rejected the offer of international scientists from the United States at least twice, again, before the visit of the WHO head, and then they decided to accept international scientists under the auspices of the WHO, the World Health Organization. And American companies have been reaching out to help and to provide medical supplies and financial support. I know Microsoft and Dell and many others that are engaged in doing business in China have stepped up to the plate to offer assistance and help. So, you know, the Chinese government's statement and what John talked about, sort of blaming the United States, really isn't appropriate. Now, is there more that the U.S. government could and should be doing? It's entirely possible. I don't know whether the Chinese government has asked for assistance that the United States has not delivered. I don't believe so. But I think it is a mistake to think that the U.S. Is not doing anything in this situation.
So now we're at the sort of the third ring of our concentric circles of analysis here, and about China and the global community. I want to ask specifically about Hong Kong, because of course Hong Kong's been undergoing months of internal turmoil over pro-democracy protests and sort of China's view on that. But now we also have coronavirus really gripping Hong Kong and further having an impact on Hong Kong's already much slowed economy. I mean, so John, could coronavirus make Hong Kong even more problematic for China?
Yeah, I mean, coronavirus is the one thing that seems to have united all of Hong Kong's various political factions in their criticism of the Hong Kong government's handling of this challenge. Now you have even pro-Beijing lawmakers and pro-Beijing parties in Hong Kong blasting the Hong Kong government for not doing more and not acting more aggressively and timely in terms of dealing with the epidemic. It's also, you know, contributed to a strike of Hong Kong health workers who are calling for the more border closures and more significant screening of passengers coming in from China. And so I think this is going to actually contribute further to the degradation of the reputation of the Hong Kong government as well. I don't know whether it has cooled clearly protests on the streets because of the health concerns of potential marchers. But on the other hand, it's really united people in the sense in Hong Kong that the government is just not up to any of the tasks that have been given to it under the 1997 Hong Kong Act to make it part of China.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm seeing here that Hong Kong is going to be requiring anyone coming in from mainland China to a mandatory 14-day quarantine upon their arrival in Hong Kong. But at the same time, even though top medical workers are they want to completely close off the border between China and Hong Kong, but the government is resisting those demands. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Carrie Lam, has not been a terribly effective or popular chief executive of Hong Kong. I mean, she does serve two masters, the Hong Kong people and Beijing. And mm-hmm. many people will say that she is very constrained in her sort of ability to maneuver because she must report and take orders to some extent from Beijing. But I think in this case, you know, she's simply afraid to close off all the borders. I think they've left three border crossings open at this point in time. And, you know, the virus is spreading in Hong Kong, and I think she will come under, and she is already under, as John pointed out, pretty severe criticism for her handling of this. You know, this is probably not the right time for her to demonstrate her political fealty to Beijing. It really is a time for her to step up and say the Hong Kong people and their, you know, physical security, their health security is my number one priority. I don't want to do this, but I feel I must to prevent the further spread of the virus.
Let's go to Chris, who's calling from New Orleans. Chris, you're on the air.
Howdy, y'all. Hey, I wanted to ask, because I have a girlfriend and a lot of friends in Vietnam, and Vietnamese people are really freaked out by the coronavirus. And I am wondering why the Vietnamese government has not closed its large land border with with China, despite other countries doing so. And I'm also wondering, are we seeing an uptick in visa rejections from neighboring countries like Vietnam?
Hmm. Chris, thank you for those questions. Elizabeth, do you have any information on that?
I actually had thought that Vietnam had closed the border, so I guess I am not up to date, or at least is not accepting flights from China. So I am not exactly sure. All different countries have responded differently. I mean, we saw in Cambodia's head, Hun Sen, actually visited China, and he wanted to visit the Cambodians who were living in Wuhan, and the Chinese government rejected his request. But, you know, Cambodia and Pakistan, for example, have stepped up to say, you know, we absolutely support the Chinese government and are taking no actions that would be deemed critical in any way of how China is handling the coronavirus. But I have to say, I guess I'm not completely up to date on what's going on with Vietnam.
Right. I'm just checking here that at least in terms of flights, yes, on the weekend, Vietnam did bar all flights to and from China, in and out of Vietnam. So at least that has happened. I don't want to say anything about whether or not Vietnam has closed the border, because we don't know that for sure. But flights, yes. So let's go to Christopher, who's calling from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So I'm calling in expressing some of my concern about how, as a society, we've seen sort of outbreaks of racism or racial fear associated with a lot of these illnesses. We saw the same thing with the SARS virus coming out of China. And I've got concerns about the ripple effect associated with these kind of events on the economy, on the lives of daily people, on a lot of our political relationships that we have with China and other countries in terms of immigration and trade disputes and things like that. And I think that we need to be aware of our Western perspective and being critical of China and their handling of these viruses and the historical paranoia about communism. And instead of looking at how Xi's rule has got more of a right-wing tilt to it than his predecessors, and understanding how that may have an effect on
right.
the way this virus has been treated.
Well, Christopher, thank you for that call and that observation about the xenophobia that very oftentimes accompanies disease outbreaks like this. John Pomfret, you just wrote about this, so share your thoughts on that.
Well, it's very fascinating. I mean, in the middle school near my house, the rumor on the playground was that all Asian kids have the coronavirus and they should be quarantined. Not like sixth graders know really what the meaning of the word quarantined is. But this is not something that's just among little kids. You see it in the acknowledgement of American university students who say that somehow psychologically they're avoiding Asian students. And even places like the University of California, Berkeley, several days ago on their Instagram account, put out a notice that said xenophobia was a normal reaction to an epidemic. That post has since been taken down. But you see this situation. So to the caller's point, I think it's important to clearly distinguish criticism of what China as a government and as a political system is doing to confront this issue, and to avoid at all costs any mixing of Chinese in that issue and using this as an excuse to basically be racist against Chinese. And the United States has a pretty ugly history of associating Asians, and particularly Chinese, with disease. We've been doing it since the 19th century. And so it's interesting that this epidemic has in some ways re-triggered some of that DNA in our system and how we're reacting on an individual level to worries about in our country about the spread of the virus.
Right. So, John and Elizabeth, we've got about five-ish minutes left here, and I wanted to just close with some questions about what coronavirus right now sort of tells us about China in the world. And here's what I mean. There was a time – China's always been massive and important, but there was a time in which things could happen internally in China, and perhaps they wouldn't produce tidal effects elsewhere in the world. But isn't coronavirus now showing us how the entire global community, the entire international community, is quite sensitive, perhaps even vulnerable to internal Chinese politics? I'm just wondering what you think about that, Elizabeth.
Sure. I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about sort of the international response and how, you know, different countries have responded very differently from, you know, the United States and Australia, Singapore on one hand, for example, and Pakistan and Cambodia on the other. So I think the political ramifications are one. Obviously, there's also significant, you know, economic economic issues that are playing out. You know, China is the world's largest exporter. It's the second largest economy in the world. You know, it's responsible for about 33% of, you know, GDP growth. So what happens in terms of this coronavirus and its impact within China on manufacturing, for example, Chinese tourism, is going to have a very significant effect globally. We've already seen
Hyundai. Can I just jump in here?
Sure, absolutely.
This is exactly the point, right? That you know, we started out by discussing sort of what some of the political decisions were in the earliest days of the outbreak and how that might have actually accelerated or made it more difficult to contain the epidemic. Then that leads to exactly the economic impacts that you're talking about that are sort of having impacts around the world. That's what I'm talking about, the sort of the sensitivity of the world economy to the internal politics of China.
Exactly. And Hyundai, for example, has already said that it's going to have to stop production in some of its factories in South Korea because it can't get the parts from China. There are at least five American companies that source completely from Wuhan. They are going to be out of business if, in fact, factories can't get back to business in Wuhan. So that supply chain issue, the interconnectedness, you know, within the global economy is significant. But let me make one last point, and that is that, you know, Secretary Ross and Secretary Pompeo have both been out on the global stage talking about the potential for coronavirus to have a positive impact on the American economy and on supply chains. And I really think that this is inappropriate, you know, on the backs of this horrible, you know, pandemic to be thinking about the positive side potentially for American supply chains, I just think is really inappropriate.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, some of those five companies that you said that source completely from Wuhan, what are they? Who are they?
They're small companies you may never have heard of, like Avantar and you know, Green Mountain Grill. And so, you know, they may not be the big Apple and, you know, Microsoft, et cetera, you know, but they're certainly significant to, you know, the people who are in the United States that work there and to the Chinese who are working there as well.
Exactly. So, John, we've got about a minute left here. Your last thoughts on sort of what coronavirus tells us about how the centrality of China in the international community.
Well, I completely agree with Liz. I mean, China really matters, and it matters so much more than it did in 2003. And literally, when China catches a cold, the rest of the world is sneezing now. At the same time, I also think that this crisis raises questions about a narrative that had been really popular in the West about the inevitability of Chinese global domination. And I think that this crisis illustrates the challenges with the Beijing consensus, if you will, the idea that China's mix of mercantilist economic policy and authoritarian top-down governance was really a model for countries to follow into the future. And I think that this virus definitely raises questions about that idea as well.
Well, John Pomfret, contributing writer for The Washington Post, former Post bureau chief in Beijing, and author of The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom, America and China, 1776 to the Present. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Elizabeth Economy, Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and Distinguishing Visiting Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, author of a number of books on China, including The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping, and the New Chinese State. Elizabeth, it was a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.